Okay, we are recording. So we are returning for our third briefing of the day. This is July 14th, 2020. And our final agenda item, this is Portland Design Commission. Our final agenda item is a briefing on the Southwest Corridor, the conceptual design report. We are getting started a little bit late. Sorry about that to everyone who is here, but we've had a couple of very good conversations with two briefings just prior to this. And our commission was joined by the Historic Landmarks Commission. So we had a big group of people for the two prior briefings. I think that Ben Nielsen is the planner working on this project and will probably do us a good introduction.
I hope it's a quick introduction too. So good evening, everyone. It's good to see you. I am going to attempt to share my screen and dive right in. I'm going to try to also make it full screen. Can everyone see my screen?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yes.
So we are talking about the Southwest Corridor today. This is probably the third time, I believe, over the last 3 years that the commission has had a briefing on the Southwest Corridor. The first time was back in June of 2018. You had another briefing in the spring of 2019, focused more on the Markham Hill connection from the Gibbs Street station up to OHSU. And now we're here again to talk about the whole line, also with a little bit of a focus on the Markham Hill connector again. So what you're seeing right here is basically the route that is the preferred alternative, as best I understand it. And I wanted to show you this image just to give you a sense of where your input, or at least staff's input in some respects, might come into play. These gray areas on the map here represent a combination of the Terwilliger Design District and the Markham Hill Plan District, both of which have design review or design overlay. Down here in some of the blue areas, these are newer design overlays that have been added in the last 2 years. And these will come into play as well. The blue areas would be subject currently to community design standards. Probably when this project actually comes in for review, we'll be using our new citywide design standards that are a part of DOSA, or I should say guidelines, excuse me, assuming that those all pass. And a gray area, we would continue to use the Terwilliger Parkway design guidelines, and more towards OHSU and Markham Hill, the Markham Hill design guidelines also come into play as well. So I wanted to give that quick introduction and then focus in a little bit just on the Markham Hill connector location again, because there are some important aspects that the commission will ultimately end up needing to make a decision about before this can be built. We don't have to get into a lot of detail today, but there are some major viewpoints that come into play, which are here, and another one kind of here, and a panoramic viewpoint here. This is all shown in the Terwilliger Parkway plan. And then just kind of focusing in on what the potential connector might start to look like. I know that our representatives from TriMet and PBOT will have a lot more to say about this and the rest of the alignment. So I'm gonna kind of gloss over these Terwilliger Parkway design guidelines and the character of Terwilliger statement. I just want you to know about them and that they're gonna come into play, and we'll be able to start thinking about them over the next couple of years. So with that, I think I'd gladly turn it over to my other city colleagues for their presentation.
Ben, can you stop sharing? There you go.
Thanks, Ben. All right, so then I'm up. Hi, everybody. I'm Teresa Boyle with Portland's Bureau of Transportation, and I am the city's lead manager for the city's involvement in this light rail transit project. I'm joined by a staff from TriMet. They'll be introducing themselves. And in fact, why don't you guys do that, unmute and do that right now?
Hi, I'm Dave Unsworth. I've been in front of you a number of different times. I'm the Director of Project and Development and Permitting for TriMet.
My name is Jeff Dorn. I'm a Senior Project Manager at TriMet. I've been managing the urban design on the project.
Thank you. All right, Dave, next slide. So as Ben mentioned, we have been before you a couple times now with this particular project. And these are episodes in the early planning phase of the project, but they certainly will not be the last time we will be together. One of the things that the TriMet Transit projects are well known for is the relationship with the Design Commission. And in the 20 plus years that I've been doing these projects, that role and that partnership has led to some really wonderful facilities and infrastructure that have been created. Speaking on behalf of myself, certainly, and I will go ahead and do it for TriMet, we're very, very grateful for that partnership. And this is a briefing. It's to catch you up kind of on where we are with the project at this point, and really just kind of lays the groundwork for our future conversations with you. Dave, next slide. Oh, good. I was hoping there was something like this. All right. So as mentioned previously, when we were talking about the prior times that we have been here, we were really focusing the DEIS update. This was in the public comment period for the environmental impact statement, and it was an overview of the entirety of the project and what we thought our alignment option might be. And your interests were broad and overarching. Definitely conversation about Markham Hill Connector, and as a matter of fact, we came back last spring when we were honing in on whether or not to do a bridge and elevator or an inclined elevator. Next slide, please. But today what we're talking about is the conceptual design report. And this is a document that's intended to translate early engineering concepts into descriptions and visuals that help everyone understand what we think the project is going to be like at a 20 to 30% level of design. We are early in a design process, but this really is intended as an opportunity for Portlanders to get a sense of what the project is. And this too is something that we've been doing as long as I've been involved in the projects. The first one that I did with the project was for the Yellow Line for Interstate Max. And we find it just to be a really good organizing opportunity to share information on the project, get feedback, and before we move into final engineering. We were doing briefings all spring, and yours is unfortunately the virtual one. Because of the pandemic, we were unable to get in any sooner, but we're very happy to have your time now. So middle of the screen in February, we released the draft report, and TriMet spent a lot of time, January, February, March timeframe, talking to neighborhood associations, individual groups of people who were interested in the project to get feedback on the preliminary designs. We'll be updating based on the information that we heard and releasing a final draft of the conceptual design report, or CDR, next month. And then in the trajectory overall of the project, we'll be completing the environmental analyses this fall. And another large milestone for us, of course, is the Metro Regional funding measure, which if that is forwarded to the ballot and if that passes, would provide a large portion of the local share of project funding. Next slide. So where we are in the project right now is in the green design phase, 2020, the conceptual design report where the star is. We will have completed our environmental review, as I mentioned. And so this is really a briefing opportunity, but you'll notice where land use actions are required, All of that activity really is happening in 2021, 2022, if we are funded to move ahead into final engineering and to move forward on that. Dave, did you have anything that you wanted to say overall about the timeline? I know that you are the kind of next step in terms of talking. Is there something about this that I have not hit yet?
No, I think you're right. I think, you know, I think November of this year with the regional funding measure, we're applying for engineering phase with our federal partner, which would provide at least half the project cost, and then going into construction in 2022, 23. So okay. I'm going to move from there. Thanks for the introduction, Teresa. You've been a great partner on all of these projects. And what we're trying to do with our transit, you know, this goes back to 1975 or so when we abandoned the Mount Hood Freeway because it took out too many houses. It was to build and connect communities with high quality transit. And we've done that. We've got 60 miles of service. The next leg here is to the south. It's a pretty difficult and challenging alignment through here. It's about 11 miles. And so you can see those connections that have been made. The nice thing about this alignment is that the green line that comes in from Clackamas Town Center that goes down to Banfield that comes down 5th and 6th Avenues would continue further south, hitting Barber Boulevard, Tigard, and Tualatin as we move forward on this alignment. And just like all of our projects, we're not just building light rail. You know, this has got 13 stations. It's that travel time that's important, both on the opening day and the future day. We expect to move about 37,000 people per average weekday. And in some portion of this, we have what we call the shared transit way, where we put two or three bus lines on the alignment that gets us into downtown quicker. So we think that's really important. And again, when we're building light rail, we're not just building building tracks. The Tillicum Crossing and the connections that were made in the South Waterfront, I think, are indicative of what we try and do with building community. This project has more than 10 miles of new sidewalks, more than 6 miles of improved bike facilities. Basically, we're improving the bike commute from the Barber Transit Center all the way into downtown Portland. Right now, it's not very good. That shared transit way, that's putting buses on our trackway, that gives them that travel time and expands the bonus or the benefit of our right-of-way that we're dealing with. We scaled down the number of park and rides from about 4,000 to 2,000 that we're talking about right now. So, and there's more. There's stormwater. There's a whole bunch more. As we do a lot of public engagement. We were involved in an outreach effort with the CDR, or the Conceptual Design Report, when COVID hit, but we were able to do a lot of virtual open houses, and this is a sample of the feedback that we heard. We use this to inform choices like, what should we be doing at Markham Hill? What connections should we be making? What stations have the strongest support? What needs the most work? So I'm gonna do a quick, let me see if I can do my magic here and see if this works. So this is a video that Donald Newlands did for us of our project. Maybe I just have to hold that. Essentially what we're doing is from downtown, we're crossing over I-405, and then we're generally in the center of Barber Boulevard through here. And all right, go. You can see OHSU up here. One thing you can notice that we used to have a bridge and elevator that connected up here. We've recognized that those visual standpoints, and we're now looking at an inclined elevator that comes and connects from the GIB station through here. It also connects, and really a sister project to this is the Ross Island Bridgehead project that really tries to make sense of the mess that is out there today with Highway 26 and ramps that go through neighborhoods. What we do is when we make a strong pedestrian connection to the Gibbs, the Darlene Hooley Bridge that provides that connection into downtown. So, you know, it's just more than that. It's trying to make the right connections at the right location. Our next station as we head further south is Hamilton. It serves Hamilton. It serves the lower area through here. And then we connect into what we call the woods. We're also, there are two viaducts here, pretty major viaducts, and a road connection up to Hillsdale. This is where those buses would connect in. So this is an important element, and a lot of work that we're doing is trying to replace those in a way that makes sense with bike lanes and sidewalks through here. As we follow down, our next station is near the Fred Meyers at 13th Avenue. We're looking at affordable housing going in and around this location. Next station is at 19th. It provides a great pedestrian connection across the freeway here. Here's a Safeway. We're replacing bridges through here. Next station is at 30th Avenue. And the station after that has been a big focus of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about what do we redo with the Barber Transit Center? How is that a different location? Then we have a bridge over both Capitol Highways and I-5. And this is a PCC of Sylvania. We make a strong connection up to that, rebuilding a road and making that a good connection. We've got another bridge over I-5, and now we're in Tigard. We're over Red Rock Creek, and I'll show you the rest of it just because I think it's important to know the whole element of it. This is Elmhurst Station. We've in a new bridge across and over Red Rock Creek and Highway 217. A Hamilton State or Hall Station, which connects into downtown Tigard, a new operating and maintenance facility. And then we connect down to a number of jobs that are down here, family wage jobs, with a station here at Bonita. This is PAC Trust land. Again, a lot of higher, better paying jobs. This is Lake Oswego over here. This is our Upper Boones Ferry Road. And then finally, our last station is at Bridgeport with a larger park and ride here and bus transfer area through this location. So that's on our website. It's also on our, also we've got that on YouTube. And so I'm gonna hand it off to Jeb Dorn, who's gonna walk us through the conceptual design report. Jeff, all yours.
Thank you, Dave and Teresa. I appreciate that, having that fly through as we kind of use the next few slides to look at some of these details of the design walkthrough and look at them a little bit more closely. And as Teresa mentioned, we do have a conceptual design report final draft coming out in August. At the heart of that document is sort of the project compass, the project's principles, goals, and objectives. We put these into the CDR because they're really helping to guide the project to help us align with the varying interests that exist all throughout the corridor and all the different community values that we've been able to identify. Not only do these principles capture the regional goals and TriMet's business plan elements, but it also covers a lot of the land use plans and partner visions that exist, not only in the city of Portland, but Tigard and Tualatin as well, the different interests of the neighborhood visions and a lot of the community input that we've received that help us identify some of those core values. The principles are really about embrace how the project is going to move people and will and connect all the different places that exist along the alignment, how we're going to identify those existing assets and create equitable communities along the alignment, be able to address climate action and help preserve with the preservation and enhancement of our natural resources. And then how do we become more resilient in our systems to address flexible design elements that help accommodate the future. This framework is really intended to highlight the project benefits, help guide decisions and design choices that we need to make. And then again, be our compass, help us measure those outcomes and determine when we've been successful. Next slide, Dave. The light rail alignment in Portland, most of it is running as a center running alignment down Barber Boulevard. Barber Boulevard is really characterized by this history of evolving transportation needs. Originally it was a trade route for the Native Americans and later used, the same route was used by settlers, early settlers. And eventually it evolved into the first railroad corridor. And then it became what we know it as today, which is a more auto-oriented development pattern. A lot of the slopes that exist in the corridor limit transportation to really one area where that results in more of a non-traditional street grid. Barber and I-5 carry heavy traffic loads. There's a pattern of parking lots and more gravel roads, incomplete sidewalks and bike facilities, and little to no existing stormwater infrastructure. On the next slide, we can see how we can pull all these pieces together. These large infrastructure projects are always transformative. And by pulling all of these pieces together, we can really create a vision where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. The design, in the past, we've always used elements of consistency to help create this universal system identity, but also recognize that we need to be flexible to enhance these different station areas to reflect their context and the different community values and visions. That's central to that design guidance is a need to just create facilities that we know are comfortable, and convenient, safe and inviting, connected and accessible, that really puts people first, to put an emphasis on the high quality design. On the next slide, we'll touch a little bit about capturing some of that past in a more visual document in our guide to standard light rail improvements in public streets. So as Teresa mentioned, there's a really strong history here of partnership between TriMet and Portland, and this document helps identify and build on those past successes. This is largely a center running alignment, so a lot of these street improvements will be looking to some of the standard improvements that we make inside of the right-of-way for street improvements and station amenities. Those standards are subject to PBOT review and input and advice from the Design Commission. And then anytime we try to substitute or make additions, we are subject to a more formal regulatory process with the Design Commission. The next slide is an image from the CDR that sort of snapshots all the different urban design toolkits, just not all of them, but just a few to give an idea about the elements that we try to pull together and that we intend to try and reuse on the this new project. The next slide kind of again highlights for you where the urban design overlays are. I won't walk through all of these, but we do start to note where all the major bridges are relative to those that fall within the design districts that Ben mentioned earlier. On the next slide, the project has really put a lot of effort into sort of developing a framework to address all the new technologies and really think through how with our consultants, Alta Planning and Fair and Peers and our urban design integration group team analyze and really apply these design efforts about developing a station access hierarchy. We know in our system that walk access is extremely important. It's the primary mode of access across our system. And in this project, 65% of the mode split is people walking to the platforms. And so we wanted to create this to emphasize that, but also to place TOD, transit-oriented development, into context. TOD brings two benefits in that it's going to increase the walk access to our transit system to help support ridership, but it also plays a key role in shifting, in creating a mode shift to help us move to more non-single occupancy vehicle trips and be less car dependent as a community. This also gives us a little more context with our what we call our mobility solutions toolkit. As we know, technology is really changing our transportation choices and how we position ourselves as a transit agency to use those mobility technologies to enhance access to our core services is really important. So together with our consultants and Teresa and her staff, we've really been able to put together a more thoughtful approach to help us define the spatial needs that we need to help support these private service providers, both in the street right away and at stations, but also be able to right size the distribution of our parking facilities, our bike parking facilities, to be able to maximize their usage. But this framework also recognizes that there still is an important need for auto access, especially in suburban areas where there's less density and less bike and park, bike and ped infrastructure. And then builds in some flexibility at both Barber Transit Center and 53rd with our surface lots to act more as a land bank and allowing for an easier transition to some future transit-oriented development. Here, you know, we are making, as Dave mentioned, we're making significant investments into the bike and ped infrastructure on this project. So north of NATO, we have a very efficient cross-section design. We really reduced the transit way, the auto lanes, and some of the bike and ped widths to help minimize the historic impacts through the South Portland neighborhood and avoid a lot of displacements. And that results in an in-lane bike facility through this section. South of NATO, down to the Barber Transit Center on the next slide. We also have an efficient layout that really minimizes or creates efficient use of auto space to retain that capacity, but then creates 21 feet on each side for race protected bike and pedestrian facilities. This creates a space that's completely separated from auto traffic, again, from Barber Transit Center north up to the NATO Barber intersection. On the next slide, we detail a little bit about protected intersection designs that really create better, safer, more comfortable environments for both bike and pedestrians. We have better sight lines. We're able to reduce the overall crossing distance to minimize pedestrian exposure to vehicles. And we're also exploring some lead interval signal timing to help increase those protections. On the next slide is a graphic that I really enjoy. It relates to the pedestrian district guidelines to increase permeability throughout the corridor. So we've put a lot of effort into identifying safer and more frequent crossings to help increase the permeability of Barber. This is just an example of the inner Barber area, so we can improve those walk and bike conditions along the alignment. The next slide highlights the stormwater infrastructure. As the slide says, we are introducing some infrastructure to treat nearly 70 acres of impervious surface along this alignment. On the next slide, Gibbs Station is one to highlight. We know that this station is really critical and it provides a link to the Markham Hill and the OHSU campus. We expect about 10,000 people a day to be using our system going up the hill to access the jobs and health services that's in the OHSU campus. Context is very important here. We have very challenging topography in the area and multiple natural and historic resources in Terwilliger Parkway, Blair Hill Park, an existence of a synagogue at the base of the hill next to the station, as well as other private properties that have some historical significance. On the next slide, just to kind of recap on the regulatory process, we know that the design of these neighborhoods and the character is of special concern because of the existence of a lot of these design overlays. There's a need to really build upon and improve the unique historic and scenic and recreational character in this area. Terwilliger Parkway provides really important habitat and environmental context. The Markham Hill Connector is located within an existing zone, and we have identified that there's a small wetland present there. The parkway itself and the Markham Hill Plan District's guidelines do apply, and we know that the South Portland Historic Overlay boundary is at the center line of Barber. So our station area is adjacent to that. The synagogue and both the synagogue and Markham Hill connection are outside of that boundary. However, we do hold a commitment to reflecting the history of the parkway and the synagogue and the Lair Hill neighborhood, South Portland neighborhood, within the design of our plaza and station. On the next slide.
Before you move from there, I think it would be just worth mentioning the amount of work and other, we had a Green Ribbon Committee that Commissioner Santner sat on, provided great advice to us, along with other key members of the community, along with a working group that helped inform. We knew that we had all these regulatory requirements. We knew that there was strongly felt issues here. So we've done quite a bit of outreach, public outreach, trying to understand the issues associated with going through this park with a new facility like that. I just wanted to mention that and thank Commissioner Santner again for her work on that committee. So. All right, back to the regular scheduled event.
Yeah. So this graphic is a visual rendering to help illustrate some of the complexity around the Gibbs Station. It really is the highest volume of pedestrians activity in our alignment. It's a modal hub center of activity. A lot of things come together with our shared transitway, which allows the buses to operate in with the light rail, similar to how they do on the Tillicum Crossing. Our light rail stations provide access for both bus and light rail vehicles. The ramp, there's a ramp here that you can see the access to that helps connect down to Gibbs to complete the Gibbs pedestrian spine and a connection between Markham Hill campus, OHSU campus, all the way down to the south waterfront via the Darlene Hooley. So this area we've identified is really ripe for a lot of that mobility solutions toolkit that I mentioned, especially with bike share. And all of this really comes together to create this high volume of pedestrians that will be linking from the station to the Markham Hill connection. On the next slide, it illustrates an issue we've been wrestling with recently about this pinch point of sidewalk that's right at the existing synagogue. TriMet is seeking environmental clearance to remove the synagogue, but we do recognize there's a lot of important history here with this facility. In 1961, an urban renewal plan attempted to relocate the congregation and the synagogue, and that attempt failed. And that resulted in this building here, which is a 1966 building, postmodern building that was created by architect John Storrs. And then in 2016, the congregation was really looking at how to address a lot of the maintenance issues, leaky roof and some other issues that they've had, and started an early assistance application process to work with the developer to tear down the synagogue and rebuild 40 units on the site. And in that process, they discovered, you know, there was a lot of conflicts with the Southwest Corridor improvements. And so they approached TriMet with a hardship acquisition request. And so TriMet worked with the FTA to approve that request and acquired the synagogue in 2018. As part of that process, we did not require the congregation to demo the building in order to alleviate that cost burden from them, for them. So the congregation has since located into Hillsdale, and they recently came to the Landmarks Commission, where they noted, you know, the congregation in their minds is really about the people and not as much the building. There are a lot of relevant cultural elements that are on the building, part of the building, as well as in the building itself, that they are removing and taking, moving to the Hillsdale location. So again, the cross section here is really minimized, and the station alignment, as demonstrated here, is really working through a lot of constraints to try and minimize impacts and avoid impacts to historic Blair Hill Park. There are multiple buildings, multi-unit apartment complexes that we're attempting to avoid displacement and turning off access to even more residences south of the site. On the next slide, it illustrates some of the conflicts at the crosswalk. We have a total capacity target of 1,400 people per hour that results in about 1,200 people one way at the peak times. So this large volume of people really necessitates some safe, comfortable, and efficient crossing design through this area. The synagogue placement isn't ideally located. It does diminish the ability for us to meet those needs, and create some potential conflicts with meeting ADA requirements, and has some insufficient width to address pedestrian through traffic, as well as accommodate the 40 to 80 people that could be queuing up at this crosswalk at any one time. So the barber improvements also do changes the profile, so it exposes some of the foundation here. And so we're really looking more closely at what that means. So we are going to do more diligence and start an adaptive reuse study with our consultants that looks at, let's better define what the synagogue conditions and the crosswalk conditions would be with the building in place, and explore options for adaptive reuse of the building. If it is here, what can it be? How can we repurpose it? And what were the alternative purposes or uses that would fit within the building? We're also going to look at partial removal. The dome is kind of a prominent landmark. Is there a way to keep the dome and remove portions? And if we can, again, what are the alternative uses that could be used for? We're also looking at relocation. To be honest, that's not likely given the structural needs of this building. But we are going to look at it more closely just to confirm. And then if it is removed, we want to make sure we understand how we can best tell the story of the synagogue and South Portland neighborhood in the station and plaza elements, as well as define what new opportunities arise in this space.
We have a memorandum of agreement with SHPO, that the State Historic Preservation Office that we're doing, and if we end up taking it down, it will be looking at documenting a number of different things, the presence of a congregation in the neighborhood, the urban renewal, telling the larger story about what has happened in this area, along with updating the South Portland Historic District. So there are things that, if you are impacting something, if we cannot avoid it, that we're working through that with the State Historic Preservation Office. In fact, we've got an open house scheduled for July 23rd to seek more input on these type of issues.
Yes. And so on this is the slide where we kind of start talking a little bit more about the Markham Hill connection. I would echo Dave's thanks to Zari to be a representative on the Green Ribbon Committee and helping guide us into the inclined elevator as the preferred alternative. This is really chosen because it does have a lower profile. It is less impactful to the Twilliger Parkway, less visible, falls below the viewpoint to avoid conflict, and minimizes a lot of the environmental impacts in the parkway itself. There is an ongoing design effort to really get into the details around capacity, and travel time, access, and safety, how we access the station, and continuing to minimize those natural and historic impacts. On the next slide, we can get some ideas of visuals as to how these landings really fall within the Twilliger guidelines. They are visible from Twilliger Parkway for both the landing at Twilliger and Campus Drive, but also the one at Barber. So the guidelines do apply. And then there's some opportunities here with views from interior to the cab to be able to frame those views. And then we've identified in our conversations with Portland Parks and Rec some need for interpretive signage to identify the parkway and place in the park landing at Twilliger Parkway, as well as some potential for trimming to help restore some of those viewpoints at the turnout and that were in Ben's diagrams earlier. On the next slide, there's a lot of project elements I'll touch on here briefly that will be coming to the Design Commission for input. Anywhere where we have lots of topography challenges in the corridor, we're always gonna end up with a lot of walls and bridges, and that is the case on this project, as you can see in our plan here. And again, you know, we do have a good history of working with the City of Portland to help define the appropriate architectural treatments, and we will continue to look to the guide here on the next slide for the standard improvements inside of the right-of-way to help understand how we can fit our bridges better into context. We often reference the Harbor Bridge as one where we can look to some materiality and other choices to help reflect some better architectural treatments. So I'm going to walk through just quickly on these next slides some of the structures in a little more detail that we'll be looking at. So this is illustrating the I-405 connection that helps us leave Center Running Barber, travel over Carruthers, Sheridan, the I-405 lanes and ramps, and then connect into our existing services in the transit mall. There's a lot of coordination needed for this particular alignment with a lot of the city projects in the area that you're all familiar with. There's the Central City in Motion, the Southwest in Motion, the Division Transit Project, and the Green Loop all interact with this in some way. On the next slide, a little bit more detail on the viaducts and Capitol Highway overpass. We will be replacing the timber structures of the viaducts and the overpass, and this gives us a really great opportunity to address a long history of bike and pedestrian safety issues in this area. By updating it to the raised protected bike lane cross section you see in the image. There is an E-zone present here, and we are still getting ready to go into the next phase of design where we'll start to have some more discussions on what the visual character of these structures are. On the next slide, we mark the show a structure that really marks the transition of the alignment from where we're center running north of Barber Transit Center into a more side running alignment. This structure takes us over Capitol Highway and Barber Boulevard to land us next to I-5 as we continue south. This is, it's really critical that we fit this within the West Portland Town Center area, and there is a design overlay that helps trigger those discussions. And again, some flexibility in the design is needed in order to be able to accommodate some of the future ODOT work in and around the Crossroads area. And then the last major structure is at 60th, which as we leave the 53rd Avenue station, we travel over I-5 and then under Pacific Highway to help us transition the project into the city of Tigard. On the last slide, the last thing I will note is there's a lot of opportunity for development along this corridor. And we've been looking at some of the properties that are in public ownership. ODOT currently owns the Barber Transit Center. And the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has been going through an inclusive communities process to help define and identify what the community priorities are for development here. There's a unique element to this because that TOD process, which I think is more unique than what we've done on past projects, is helping to inform the light rail design. So for example, here we're looking at some side running alignments to help understand if there's ways that we can make some modifications to further enhance these opportunities. And with that opportunity could come more potential to help advance this development along with the light rail project. So in general, TriMet is really supportive of mixed use and mixed income development along at all of our station areas. And we do have an affordable housing MOU that we will be looking at to make the properties along the prime alignment available for up to 600 to 750 units of affordable housing in Portland. So with that, I will stop here and ask if there's, you know, if there's any questions or comments from the commission.
Gosh, great presentation and really neat flyover. Thanks for sharing that. I want to check in and be sure that there is no one here to provide public comment this evening. Laura, I have not received anything that tells me we will be having public comment. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay, right on. So we can have open conversation. Commissioners, who has questions or comments they would like to provide? And, you know, Ben, I should check in with you and be sure that you don't have more prepared notes for us and topics that you want to be sure that we check in on.
No, I left it fairly open-ended for you. I think in my mind, the biggest lift is going to be how to deal with the Markham Hill connector.
Yeah.
A lot of the other details are, if not standard details, they're close. They'd probably be close to standard, and it's just adapting them for specific neighborhoods or situations. But I don't want to exclude anything from conversation.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Julie?
Yes.
Julie? Declarations?
Oh. That's very good point.
I forgot
very
too.
Good point.
Did we do that?
So it is a briefing. This is not a land use action.
Okay.
Nonetheless, it is good. It is always good to disclose if any commissioner has potentially a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact. And I'm guessing that Commissioner McCarter may.
Yes. Commissioner Brian McCarter, I work for CGF, which is one of the design team joint venture partners.
Okay. Any other commissioner?
Nope.
No.
Okay. I will disclose that I am married to someone who works at ZGF and will eventually disclose that conflict of interest if there is a land use action. So there you go. ZGF always.
Yeah. Those guys.
Okay. Commissioners, what would you like to introduce as discussion topics? Where should we begin?
Go ahead, Zeri.
No, go ahead, Chandra.
Okay, thanks. So is the synagogue a historic resource?
The synagogue, we're charged with going through and determining if it's eligible for the National Register, and we have gone through the documentation. And we're vetting that with both FTA and the SHPO. And we believe our proposal was that it is eligible. So we need to treat it as if it is on the National Register. Therefore, if we impact that, we've got to propose mitigation. We've got to show that we've taken all prudent and feasible alternative to impacting that. And we've basically looked at efforts to minimize the harm to the property and the structure itself. Because we have the incline elevator there, we're already adversely impacting the site that it's on. So there's already considered to be an adverse impact to the site. Now, more of this is emotional about the building and the age of the building and what do we do with that resource.
So I think it wasn't really clear from the presentation why that crossing at the street had to be so close to the synagogue. Because not having, you know, seen all the constraints, because it's a very complex area, obviously, and you can't present all of that, but why couldn't just shift south or north of the synagogue to kind of get out of the way so that there's not 2 feet left of the sidewalk? That part wasn't quite so clear to me.
I should be sharing a screen here, and let me see if I can enlarge this.
Yep.
went to the very end. Hold on. Start from this slide, would you? Actually, I'll just do it this way.
Well, I was just making it bigger, smaller. There you go.
So essentially what's happening is we have to widen, and we want to have a station at Gibbs Street. The reason we want to have a station at Gibbs Street is because that's the alignment that goes down to the south waterfront across the Darling-Hooley Bridge. So this is the right location for it. And this is the best connection that minimizes harm. It's an area that already was degraded when utilities went in there before. So we've tried to minimize the harm on Markham Hill. We've tried to make sure that we provide the best access up to what you don't see up here. If you went up here, you'd see that campus drive, which is the main circulator in through the campus. So we're lining these up. The width of this is problematic because if you are widening to this side, you're into the South Auditorium Historic District. So you're taking out other contributing resources to that. And more importantly, you're more adversely affecting Lair Hill Park, which is both a park, which has special standards to it, and also a historic park, which has other standards for it. So we've been looking at balancing how we widen and fit this facility in here, knowing that we want bike lanes in here, sidewalks in here. We have a shared transit way. And because we have so many people getting off this station, up to 13,000 people a day at the station, we've got to be very careful about how we safely get people across the street. One of the things that we spent a long time looking at, let me see if I can pull this up over here, is really what we did at the Tillicum Crossing, and the work that we did and the lessons that we learned in having pedestrian cross roadways where you have trains, buses, streetcars coming across here. We learned a lot of different things. In fact, we flipped where the green paint was and where the pedestrians were on this route because it didn't work. So we looked at it. So we know where people can that don't pay attention. I'm running across the street for a bus. I'm running across the street for the inclined elevator. Most importantly, we want to make sure that what we build is safe, understandable, and can work. And what we're seeing with this is we are pinched here. There's not enough room here in order to really stack the people up that want to cross here. So we've looked at sliding the station back and forth, and we've come to the conclusion with a series of architects looking at that we can't really do that. Where the shared transit way goes and how that goes, we think that we've got the right place for the sidewalk. That is very close to where that building is. That's very close to where that walls are. It's very close to their access down into the basement. So our call has been, because you got to go through it both on the federal side and the local side, is let's make a more conservative standpoint and say that we're already adversely impacting the building or the site. We are likely to remove portions of that building. Does that help?
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Dave, could you bring up slide 27? Yep. And maybe either you or Jeb could describe. There's a really unique thing about the shared transit way and right side door buses here that create this little chicane right at the point where these crosswalks have to occur. I think that might answer Chandra's question. Yeah. Why is this unusual like that?
I think that's a great idea. So what the shared transit way is, this is a train that's coming down through here. After that train goes through, this bus will now jump on this trackway. So we know that some people may be transferring from this train, crossing here to access this pathway that goes down to the Darling-Hooley Bridge to the South Waterfront. Similarly, we want to make sure that people can cross through here and access and go up to the inclined elevator. This footprint here, this is where the synagogue is, and there's some SEPTED principles we want to be careful for here. But essentially we want these sight lines, so someone to be looking at both the train and the bus to make sure that they are looking in the right direction and not going to be impacted. And we also recognize that some of these people will be crossing to go into downtown. So this is a bus that's going into downtown. A train would be coming down along these tracks going into downtown. So we need to provide this access, both people getting off here, going to work, coming back here, getting on that train, getting on that bus. This becomes very problematic at exactly the wrong location. It is very tight where we are already substandard in our sidewalk and we have an ADA ramp through here. So Brian,
can you hopefully back to that overview again real quick?
Which so, one?
The one that Brian had us go to.
Yep.
Yeah, there we go. So I get what you're saying. It's complex. There's a lot of things in the way. All I'm saying is, like, why isn't the crosswalk there instead? It's just out of the way of the synagogue.
There's not enough stacking distance really here for people who cross this way and are waiting for that train or others to come across. I mean, there are things that
this crosswalk is here, right? Everything just shifts basically this direction by a little bit to make that happen. That is possible.
If I could jump in here.
Then you start getting into larger buildings that are down here, other buildings, because you can't really move it this way if you're starting to do it. This whole thing's got to widen, and it widens down here, and now we're impacting some bigger buildings that are around here, like 3 or 4 story buildings.
Another key point of that is if you can go back one slide, Dave, that's not really represented well in plan view. Cross sections would show the really challenging topography that we're dealing with on these street profiles, and how Gibbs and Whitaker and Woods connect in, but also the access road there that you can see labeled as number 6, and how that closely that gets into Barber, where there's actually a number 6 on the west side of the road.
No.
There's 2 number 6s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that in order for us to be able to maintain that access, which is critical for many of the apartment complexes to the south of that, we're really pushed up against Barber with a really fairly large retaining wall there separating the streets. And as we start to shift that station south with the how we taper back and the turn lanes, we start to impact that ability to maintain that access. And that opens a much bigger area of impact over a lot of the residences. We have started to have some conversations around, could we skew the crosswalk and what are the implications of that? With a skewed crosswalk, we do end up with longer crossing distances, more pedestrian exposure. We lose capacity to handle some of those larger crowds of people, the 40 to 80 people that I mentioned. And then there's questions about the angle that would be required to make that and whether that gets into some ADA accessibility issues with people in mobility devices crossing the tracks. And so we're digging into those details a little bit more to help understand that. The big challenge is, when we get to the top of the landing of that ramp, we have just under 6 feet of space, which is basically enough for an ADA landing. That would not be big enough for the capacity of people or to get any through pedestrian traffic through there. So we're gonna, part of the study with the synagogue is some of the walls and other things that are right there. Can we remove them? Can we alter them? Can we do something to open up that space? Or does that damage the structural integrity of the synagogue too much? We'll get smarter about that.
I'm sure if you could avoid it, you would, but it sounds like you cannot avoid running right into the building. So I will leave that there. I was just curious why you couldn't just shift a little bit, but you can't. There's a lot of other things happening. So
it wouldn't be our first choice to take down a historic synagogue. It's not the way that we do work. So there is good reason, and I think there's some good rationale. And I appreciate the challenges of saying, can you slide? Can you do? I think the design team's been doing a lot of that. The Landmarks Commission that we went to, 3 weeks ago, kind of did the same thing. If you can't avoid it, how can you reuse that building itself? And so we're looking into that as well.
And my only other comment was that if you're going to do those really cool inclinators, that it would also be cool to have stairs in some area, because I think having a good opportunity for people to run up a hill on stairs as exercise is pretty interesting. And people do it a lot in Forest Park and different areas. But if it could be more than just an elevator, at an incline, if it turned into a public realm kind of space, might be interesting. And it might not be able to happen the whole length because maybe it's way too steep, but in order to make it not just infrastructure, like it's the light rail just going up a hill, you know, to add some element that gives back to the public realm and creates something interesting would be cool.
Yeah, in our conversations with Portland Parks Bureau, we believe that we will be putting about $600,000 into improvements for a trail that connects up to here and a trail that connects basically down this area. So we're looking at trying to address that through some, what I call would be mitigation for the removal of trees that will occur with the project. So there's been an in-depth and long conversation with Portland Parks about what does this impact mean to the trees? What does that mean to the natural environment? One of the concerns that we heard from Portland Parks was the wildlife that goes through there. It's a wildlife corridor, and concerns about more light, more activity. And so from that, we looked at investing off of there on a trail that we would team with probably OHSU and I think Parks to improve as we move forward. Here you go.
That's Southwest Trails number one, which has an existing set of stairs that we would be, you know, contributing the finances for them, for Portland Parks and Rec to make the upgrades.
Cool.
Your point is well taken, which is, can this be a good public realm space? Can it be cool? And I think we're going to be having a lot of conversations as we move along with the project about what this all can be. If it's not stairs, how do people interact? How do they use the space? It certainly is a unique facility for all of us here. And I can assure you, we will be talking a lot more with you guys about this.
That's great. Those are all my comments. Anyone else can go next.
Well, I, as a member of the, what was it called? Green?
Blue Ribbon.
Corridor? Green, oh, ribbon. Green Ribbon Committee. That's Green right. Ribbon. Green Ribbon Committee. I really want to commend TriMet, the way they approach working with various stakeholders. And also, I want to commend them for not seeing themselves and their role as just an infrastructure agency. And they look to all aspects of how the work that they will do have more significant impact, whether it's urban design, whether it's social outcomes and diversity. So it was great. And, you know, in that process, we explored, I think, 5 or 6 various options. And they were very methodical about listening to people. And I'm very pleased to see that the connector, the incline elevator is getting really the highest priority. I think in addition to safety and connection and accessibility, one thing that that committee wanted to see, and I think you folks are delivering it as far as I can see, is creating iconic facilities for city, as you did with Telecom Bridge. And so I'm very, very pleased to see what you're doing. One question that I have is, the alignment from basically Fifth Avenue over I-5 and over Carruthers and coming down, which is elevated. I'm hoping that you are paying a lot of attention about how the area underneath and their design, so that they are amenities. They're not just bridges. They're not just columns. They are things that, especially when they're on land and adjacent to buildings, are become asset to whatever that may happen around them. I'm sure you haven't gotten to that level of detail for those areas, but my question is that something that is in the realm of possibilities?
I think so. That's a good challenge for us. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is one of those structures that
right.
from our prior experience with the harbor structure, the one that goes from NATO Parkway for the Orange Line from NATO Parkway right. down into South Waterfront, we know the Design Commission had a great deal of interest in that particular structure. And I love that idea of already beginning to point us towards the underneath part. And if I hadn't right. jumped in and let Jeb speak instead, he would talk to you about the Kellogg structure down in the city of Milwaukee and similar conversations that were had then about what's the experience for someone walking underneath, what does that bridge look like? And this is really one of those ones that we with you will be talking about a lot.
Yeah, I think there are incredible opportunities. And also you want to avoid the adverse impact that structures, elevated structures like that could have within the city limits. So, and there are incredible opportunities for arts and spaces, you know, recreation, things like that could use that area as well as being particular about the design of beneath those structures.
I wanted to take a second to chime in on the Milwaukee structure that Teresa referenced. Being a relatively new resident of Milwaukee myself, it's been great to have TriMet pay attention to the underside of that bridge and provide a connection over the lake. So,
great.
My two cents.
It was quite a battle. Miami's doing something called the Underline. It's a park that they're, you know, you've heard of the High Line. This is the Underline. So it is looking
exactly.
How do you make something that is, they've got a very, very different urban setting in some regards, but they've got mobility devices and those kind of things underneath their structure. So it's a 10-mile thing. It's interesting to watch and see how it's going to develop, but we've been keeping our eye on things like that as well.
Excellent.
So of the 11 miles of new alignment, what percentage of it is elevated? And do you have any idea yet? I know you've got just a ton of work to do, but of that is elevated, is it elevated a little bit or a lot?
Well, this is the picture. Wait, the bridge. Where's the bridge? Is it further ahead?
Top. Oh. Right there.
Yeah.
This isn't all of the bridges. You know, this is really just the major significant ones that are longer and with the design review areas. We have a series of smaller ones that go over 26th. We have a really long one, two actually, in Tiger Tualatin area that go over 217. Also the railroad corridor, Bonita is an elevated station. Make no mistake, this alignment relies on structure to achieve it, getting to Bridgeport.
Yeah. Jeff, I would say though that we are in the city of Portland, we're really adding two new structures. We're adding a structure over I-405 and we're adding a structure over Capitol Highway and really Capitol Highway and I-5, really down here, I would say that's on the border of it. The other structures, replacement. So we're mostly at grade. However, some of our at grade is on bridges and we've got to replace those. So the two, go ahead.
Okay, it really is episodic then. It's not as if there is a significant length of elevated ribbon anywhere.
I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the coming in and out of downtown will be quite an episode. As it goes past South Terminus, as it comes out of the grid and rises up over I-405 and then ties back in down by Dunaway Park. The other bridge of significance is really going to be the one down at the Barber Capitol Highway intersection with PCC is in the foreground here in this up the hill as it goes over I-5. And those will definitely be very noticeable when you are on the train because they will be fairly lengthy. And those are the ones that I think as opposed to anything else where you are in a light rail system, within a roadway segment, any of the other structures, a person is not going to perceive them in the same way as these singular items.
Yeah. Well, Dave, in the presentation somewhere, there's an image of it must be Orange Line. It's the elevated piece of harbor that goes through South Waterfront, and you know, well, that structure.
None of these are harbor.
Okay. Right. Well, the standard design.
That didn't get in there.
The standard design that's shown here, right. it's very elegant. You know, and if this is what you anticipate is going to roll out along the Southwest Corridor, you know, that's a really great structure that looks like it had good input from a previous design commission, and there is a lot of opportunity underneath it. I mean, echoing what Zeri said, there is so much potential here. It's really good. Exciting.
We're excited too.
Commissioner Sam Rodriguez had to leave, and I think that leaves us with four commissioners. Comments or thoughts from Brian, although it sounds as though you may have heard a lot from Brian already.
I actually need to depart too, but okay. I do get to look over my colleagues' shoulders and see what they're up to, and it really is. It's as you guys have all been saying, it's a really great connected process with a lot of conversations with partners and stakeholders, and I think it shows in the quality of the CDR. So hats off to the team.
Thanks.
So I have one question. This idea of probably allowing for 600 plus units of affordable housing, is this related to the community's concern about gentrification along the way? Is that adequate in your view? And I'm just interested in knowing about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we entered into an IGA. So I think there's a recognition that there has been significant economic displacement of people of color, low income, in North and Northeast Portland. And so the intent was, how do you do this project differently? So we've done this from a engagement very differently. You know, we've actually paid community members to come to meetings and to listen to us. We've got this thing called the Southwest Equitable Development Strategy. It has many, many different outcomes. It was really run by Metro, but it was really driven by the community. And in fact, they got a Meyer Memorial Trust that actually funds about $250,000 so that engagement can continue. But for what we were asked to do is, we have property that we stage on, that we have to purchase property in order to build the project. What do you do when you're done with that? Normally, we'd like to put it into transit-oriented development. The request that came from Washington County, City of Tigard, Metro, Planning Sustainability Bureau, Affordable Housing Bureau, and Prosper Portland was, can't we do something different? So what we're looking at doing is repurposing property that we may own and putting it into affordable housing in a partnership with all of these other folks who have some of the money for the increment. So our intent is a commitment for us up to 950 units along the alignment of affordable housing on property that we're owned. We think the city of Portland will actually have more with the Ross Island Bridgehead and parcels that are cleaned up and made more logical about the roadway network that we have. So I think we are doing things differently. And I know I talk about, I'm on groups around colleagues around the country, and we're probably leading the way in how we're approaching this at this stage of the project. So a commitment to bring that property forward. City of Portland, I believe Prosper is looking at a tax increment financing district, and it's also able to use Metro's $653 million affordable housing measure that was passed in part because of Southwest Corridor. In addition, Metro's regional funding measure has anti-displacement dollars in that can be used to help fund some of these elements as we move forward. So there's definitely a different way of looking at how we think about housing and how we think about low income at the same time. So if you look at all the affordable housing units in the city of Portland, about 75% of those are located in near our station areas. So
we
recognize that if you're challenged with money, you know, you can either afford a house, you can afford transportation, or you can afford food. If you can put someone in a house at an affordable standpoint near a transit location, they're able to afford more food, get to better access to the places, and have a better life.
So one of the other components of it, Commissioner, because I heard that the gentrification term really clearly, is before we started our work in laying out the roadway with track, we did an inventory of all of the existing housing units along there that are currently affordable for people. There is a surprising, or maybe not surprising, but along Barber Boulevard, there is a lot of that. And we used that to guide our choices with how to retain that while we have to widen a roadway section, and what side do we widen to avoid housing. And so that was structurally really in the bones of this project in a way that we have not ever done before.
Excellent.
Commissioner,
yeah, because there are a lot of immigrant communities along your route.
Yeah.
So making sure that they could still remain in the area and retain them, that's very important. Yeah.
You know, I worked on the Southwest Equitable Development Strategy in the early days and did a bunch of committee work there. One of the most interesting and also risky things about Southwest Portland and affordability is that most of the affordable housing in this part of our city is naturally occurring affordable housing. It is not housing that is tied to any type of formal subsidy, and it's also not protected in any way. Mm-hmm. And so all of the residents in this part of town who are living in housing that is affordable to them, that could change tomorrow.
Right.
And so this commitment for new affordable housing units, this is legitimate affordable housing that is designed to serve people at a certain economic status and to be affordable to them for the life of the housing. This is good. This is such a solid plan. It's just all of the partner agencies that have been working on this have done such good work with the long-term planning around housing and anti-gentrification.
I would double down on that. I think there is the idea that some of these funds can be used to purchase what we call unregulated affordable housing. How do we get out ahead of this? It's much less expensive to, as you well know, to house someone in an existing unit than to build it new. The cost of building isn't that different between a market rate and a subsidized unit. So that means someone's got to bring a lot of subsidy in. So if you can be smart about that, we know that the Housing Bureau is looking at some hotels, much like they did in the Rose Quarter, purchase a hotel, make it almost like an SRO that can have some benefit for smaller groups, you know. So you've got to start in a lot of different levels. I'm a transit guy, that's not what I do, but I found that I got into the SWED stuff pretty heavily because it was important for our success of this project. And part of that was this MOU and bringing, what part does TriMet bring? It's a regional problem. We're part of the solution, and we're not the only part of the solution. It's going to take a whole bunch of people to help make sure that we house people properly.
I should chime in for a second too. I'm involved with the BPS's work on the West Portland Town Center, which is focused around the Barber Transit Center. And in their planning, one of the goals is to retain a lot of this naturally affordable housing through identifying different code provisions, different bonuses that can be used. They're being really creative, I think, with this planning effort and working within the kind of confines of Oregon land use law to come up with solutions to help retain the immigrant community that is really thriving right now in that particular part of town.
Well, good work, guys. We look forward to seeing more of this stuff in the future.
You will be. Thank you. At least we hope you will. We hope we will be continuing to work on this
right
post-November.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Thank you. We thank you for your continued advice and encouragement as we move forward. So thank you.
Thanks for the great briefing.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you for the marathon. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for staying late. Good to see everyone.
Thank you. Bye bye.
See you guys.
Okay, thanks a bunch, everybody. Tim Herron, I was a little late to arrive today. Were there any items of interest? Is there anything to cover now? We're going to meet again in 2 days. I'm pretty sure we can do it then.
you and me both. I bailed on a kid duty thing, and then the internet went down, and then the internet came back, and it was a crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my internet just cut out right at the end here too. I hope I didn't miss anything that I was supposed to have said.
You're good. No, yeah, there were service interruptions all over. Sam had problems, yeah. The city had problems. I heard someone else had, I don't know what or why.
The city was totally down for a big chunk of the day.
Yeah.
Ah. Okay. Well, see you guys on Thursday.
Yep. Okay. See y'all at 1:30 on
Thursday. Is it going to be shorter, Julie?
You know, I'm looking, Zeri, my question exactly, and I'm looking at the agenda at this very minute. What we have on the agenda for Thursday is the discussion around the McAdam character statement.
Right.
That has an hour and a half on the agenda. And then remember the works project
Jessup and Montana.
Yeah. In North Portland at Montana and Jessup. Right. That's back. So
Just the two.
It's pretty light.
Those are the two items, yeah.
And I think that the Montana and Jessup appeal is first, so we get the land use the way.
Oh, good. Okay. Very good.
Yeah, and we then, did. That hasn't been switched yet.
Yeah it's not on the agenda yet. And then you can focus in on character statement for McAdam with as much time as you need.
Okay.
All good.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
We're adjourned. We'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Stay safe out there. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.